Chapter 10. And Mrs. Leaf Sage, and was the letter which had opened her eyes to these things, and a smile rose to her lips at the mere feeling of the paper between her fingers. The thrill it sent through her gave a keener edge to every sense. She felt, saw, breathed the shining world, as though a thin impenetrable veil had suddenly been removed from it. Just such a veil, she now perceived, had always hung between herself and life. It had been like the stage gauze which gives an illusive air of reality to the painted scene behind it, yet proves it, after all, to be no more than a painted scene. As he had been hardly aware, in her girlhood, of differing from others in this respect. In the well-regulated, well-fed summer's world the unusual was regarded as either immoral or ill-bred, and people with emotions were not visited. Sometimes, with a sense of groping in a topsy-turvy universe, Anna had wondered why everybody about her seemed to ignore all the passions and sensations which formed the stuff of great poetry and memorable action. In a community composed entirely of people like her parents, and her parents' friends, she did not see how the magnificent things one read about could ever have happened. She was sure that if anything of the kind had occurred in her immediate circle, her mother would have consulted the family clergyman, and her father perhaps even have rung up the police, and her sense of humor compelled her to own that, in the given conditions, these precautions might not have been unjustified. Little by little the conditions conquered her, and she learned to regard the substance of life as a mere canvas for the embroideries of poet and painter, and its little swept and fenced and tended surface as its actual substance. It was in the visioned region of action and emotion that her fullest hours were spent, but it hardly occurred to her that they might be translated into experience, or connected with anything likely to happen to a young lady living in West 55th Street. She perceived, indeed, that other girls, leading outwardly the same life as herself, and seemingly unaware of her world of hidden beauty, were yet possessed of some vital secret which escaped her. There seemed to be a kind of Freemasonry between them. They were wider awake than she, more alert, and surer of their wants, if not of their opinions. She supposed they were cleverer, and accepted her inferiority good-humoredly, half aware, within herself, of a reserve of unused power which the others gave no sign of possessing. This partly consoled her for missing so much of what made their rude time, but the resulting sense of exclusion, of being somehow laughingly but firmly debarred from a share of their privileges, threw her back on herself, and deepened the reserve which made envious mothers cite her as a model of ladylike repression. Love, she told herself, would one day release her from this spell of unreality. She was persuaded that the sublime passion was the key to the enigma, but it was difficult to relate her conception of love to the forms it wore in her experience. Two or three of the girls as he had envied for their superior acquaintance with the arts of life had contracted, in the course of time, what were variously described as romantic or foolish marriages. One even made a runaway match, and languished for a while under a cloud of social reprobation. Here, then, was passion in action, romance converted to reality. Yet the heroines of these exploits returned from them untransfigured, and their husbands were as dull as ever when one had to sit next to them at dinner. Her own case, of course, would be different. Someday she would find the magic bridge between West 55th Street and life, once or twice as he had even fancied that the clue was in her hand. The first time was when as he had met young Darrow. She recalled even now the stir of the encounter. But his passion swept over her like a wind that shakes the roof of the forest without reaching its still glades or rippling its hidden pools. He was extraordinarily intelligent and agreeable, and her heart beat faster when he was with her. He had a tall, fair, easy presence, and a mind in which the lights of irony played pleasantly through the shades of feeling. She liked to hear his voice almost as much as to listen to what he was saying, and to listen to what he was saying almost as much as to feel that he was looking at her, Everybody wanted to kiss her, and she wanted to talk to him about books and pictures, and have him insinuate the eternal theme of their love into every subject they discussed. Whenever they were apart, a reaction set in. She wondered how she could have been so cold, called herself a prude and an idiot, questioned if any man could really care for her, and got up in the dead of night to try new ways of doing her hair. But as soon as he reappeared, her head straightened itself on her slim neck, and she sped her little shafts of irony, or flew her little kites of erudition, while hot and cold waves swept over her, and the things she really wanted to say choked in her throat, and burned the palms of her hands. Often she told herself that any silly girl who had waltzed through a season would know better than she how to attract a man and hold him. But when she said man, she did not really mean George Darrow. Then one day, at a dinner, she saw him sitting next to one of the silly girls in question. The heroine of the elopement which had shaken West 55th Street to its base. The young lady had come back from her adventure, no less silly than when she went. And across the table, the partner of her flight, a fat young man with eyeglasses, sat stolidly eating terrapin and talking about polo and investments. The young woman was undoubtedly as silly as ever, yet after watching her for a few minutes, Miss Summers perceived that she had somehow grown luminous, perilous, obscurely menacing to nice girls and the young men they intended eventually to accept. Suddenly, at the sight, a rage of possessorship awoke in her. She must save Darrow, assert her right to him at any price. Pride and reticence went down in a hurricane of jealousy. She heard him laugh, and there was something new in his laugh. She watched him talking, he sat slightly sideways, a faint smile beneath his lids, lowering his voice as he lowered it when he talked to her. She caught the same inflections, but his eyes were different. It would have offended her once, if he had looked at her like that. Now her one thought was that none, but as he had a right, to be so looked at. And that girl of all others. What illusions could he have about a girl who, hardly a year ago, had made a fool of herself over the fat young man stolidly eating terrapin across the table? If that was where romance and passion ended, it was better to take to district visiting her algebra. All night she lay awake, and wondered what was she saying to him? How shall I learn to say such things? And she decided that her heart would tell her that the next time they were alone together the irresistible word would spring to her lips. He came the next day, and they were alone, and all she found was I didn't know that you and Kitty Mayne were such friends. He answered with indifference that he didn't know it either, and in the reaction of relief she declared she's certainly ever so much prettier than she was. She's rather good fun, he admitted, as though he had not noticed her other advantages, and suddenly Anna saw in his eyes the look as he had seen there the previous evening. She felt as if he were leagues and leagues away from her. All her hopes dissolved, and she was conscious of sitting rigidly, with high head and straight lips, while the irresistible word fled with a last wing beat into the golden mist of her illusions. She was still quivering with the pain and bewilderment of this adventure when Fraser Leith appeared. She met him first in Italy, where she was traveling with her parents, and the following winter he came to New York. In Italy he had seemed interesting. In New York he became remarkable. He seldom spoke of his life in Europe, and let drop but the most incidental allusions to the friends, the tastes, the pursuits which filled his cosmopolitan days, but in the atmosphere of West 55th Street he seemed the embodiment of a storied past. He presented Miss Summers with a prettily bound anthology of the old French poets, and, when she showed a discriminating pleasure in the gift, observed with his grave smile, I didn't suppose I should find anyone here who would feel about these things as I do. On another occasion he asked her acceptance of a half-effaced 18th century pastel which he had surprisingly picked up in a New York auction room. I know no one, but you who would really appreciate it, he explained. He permitted himself no other comments, but these conveyed with sufficient directness that he thought her worthy of a different setting. That she should be so regarded by a man living in an atmosphere of art and beauty, and esteeming them the vital elements of life, made her feel for the first time that she was understood. Here was someone whose scale of values was the same as hers, and who thought her opinion worth hearing on the very matters which they both considered of supreme importance. The discovery restored her self-confidence, and she revealed herself to Mr. Leaf as he had never known how to reveal herself to Darrow. As the courtship progressed, and they grew more confidential, her suitor surprised and delighted her by little explosions of revolutionary sentiment. He said, "Shall you mind, I wonder, if I tell you that you live in a dreadfully conventional atmosphere?" And, seeing that she manifestly did not mind, "Of course I shall say things now, and then that will horrify your dear delightful parents. I shall shock them awfully, I warn you." In confirmation of this warning, he permitted himself an occasional playful fling at the regular church-going of Mr. and Mrs. Summers, at the innocuous character of the literature in their library, and at their guileless appreciations in art. He even ventured to banter Mrs. Summers on her refusal to receive the irrepressible Kitty Mayne, who, after a rapid passage with George Darrow, was now involved in another and more flagrant adventure. "In Europe, you know, the husband is regarded as the only judge in such matters. As long as he accepts the situation," Mr. Leaf explained to Anna, who took his view the more emphatically in order to convince herself that, personally, he had none but the most tolerant sentiments toward the lady. The subversiveness of Mr. Leaf's opinions was enhanced by the distinction of his appearance and the reserve of his manners. He was like the anarchist with a gardenia in his buttonhole who figures in the higher melodrama. Every word, every allusion, every note of his agreeably modulated voice gave Anna a glimpse of a society at once freer and finer, which observed the traditional forms, but had discarded the underlying prejudices, whereas the world she knew had discarded many of the forms and kept almost all the prejudices. In such an atmosphere as his, an eager young woman, curious as to all the manifestations of life, yet instinctively desiring that they should come to her in terms of beauty and fine feeling, must surely find the largest scope for self-expression. Study, travel, the contact of the world, the comradeship of a polished and enlightened mind, would combine to enrich her days and form her character. And it was only in the rare moments, when Mr. Leaf's symmetrical blonde mask bent over hers, and his kiss dropped on her like a cold smooth pebble, that she questioned the completeness of the joys he offered. There had been a time, when the walls on which her gaze now rested had shed a glare of irony on these early dreams. In the first years of her marriage, the sober symmetry of giver had suggested only her husband's neatly balanced mind. It was a mind, she soon learned, contentedly absorbed in formulating the conventions of the unconventional. West 55th Street was no more conscientiously concerned than giver with the momentous question of hat people did. It was only the type of deed investigated that was different. Mr. Leaf collected his social instances with the same seriousness and patience as his snuff boxes. He exacted a rigid conformity to his rules of non-conformity, and his skepticism had the absolute accent of a dogma. He even cherished certain exceptions to his rules, as the book collector prizes a effective first edition. The Protestant church-going of Anna's parents had provoked his gentle sarcasm, but he prided himself on his mother's devoutness, because Madame de Chantel, in embracing her second husband's creed, had become part of a society which still observes the outward rites of piety. Anna, in fact, had discovered in her amiable and elegant mother-in-law an unexpected embodiment of the West 55th Street ideal. Mrs. Summers and Madame de Chantel, however strongly they would have disagreed as to the authorized source of Christian dogma, would have found themselves completely in accord on all the momentous minutiae of drawing-room conduct, Yet Mr. Leaf treated his mother's foibles with a respect which Anna's experience of him forbade her to attribute wholly to filial affection. In the early days, when she was still questioning the Sphinx instead of trying to find an answer to it, she ventured to tax her husband with his inconsistency. You say your mother won't like it if I call on that amusing little woman who came here the other day and was let in by mistake, but Madame de Chantel tells me she lives with her husband, and when mother refused to visit Kitty Mayne you said, Mr. Leaf's smile arrested her. Why, dear child, I don't pretend to apply the principles of logic to my poor mother's prejudices. But if you admit that they are prejudices, there are prejudices and prejudices. My mother, of course, got hers from Monsieur de Chantel, and they seem to me as much in their place in this house as the pot pourri in your hawthorn jar. They preserve a social tradition of which I should be sorry to lose the least perfume. Of course I don't expect you, just at first, to feel the difference, to see the nuance. In the case of little Madame de Vireville, for instance, you point out that she's still under her husband's roof. Very true, and if she were merely a Paris acquaintance, especially if you had met her, as one still might, in the right kind of house in Paris, I should be the last to object to your visiting her. But in the country it's different. Even the best provincial society is what you would call narrow. I don't deny it. And if some of our friends met Madame de Vireville at Giverwell, it would produce a bad impression. You're inclined to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.